Hello, six pack of confidence. Been so many nights since we first met. Glad to see you brought all your friends for another night of Plastic Cup Politics.
Hey, how's it going, everybody? Thanks for hitting play on a new episode of Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. I'm your host, Mark LaRue. He is Dr. Sean Hayes, PhD, who just recently, much like Bernie Sanders, found out that he was in a different tax bracket, is a securities analyst, or was, for the finance and travel industries. I'm sure that's still in the ballpark, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right. And he's it's not going to interfere with your run for state legislature in 2020, is it?
It should not.
All right. You heard it. So we're still on for 2020. He is Dr. Sean Hayes. That PhD is in political science. This is Plastic Cup Politics Podcast. It is a drinking and politics podcast based right here in Arizona, which I guess I can't really say right here. It's technically only right here for you and I, even though I do know we have other listeners here, but I shouldn't be able to throw out a blanket statement of right here, because I've seen some of those numbers. I've seen some of the numbers, and we have hits from all over the world, which is shocking to me.
Pretty awesome.
It really is. If you want to interact with them and us and people around the world, or you can just lurk in the background, you can do that at Plastic Cup Pod on all your favorite social media sites. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We will get right into what this podcast is about, which is about politics and drinking and our home state of Arizona. But first, I will let you know that, you know, the tax man and having to actually get paid kind of interrupted our schedule a little bit. So this episode is going to come out a day or two late. We are recording on the 16th. Tax day was yesterday. Did you do your taxes?
Yeah. Yeah, we did taxes.
Did you see a big jump?
No, we lost money a lot relative to last year. We got hosed by the Trump tax reform.
I think I must be just that low end of middle class to where it really didn't affect me at all. So I guess you can look at your own tax refund and decide how you feel about it yourself. Didn't affect me at all. Affected Sean. Look at your own, man. I think this is definitely one of those things where right about now you can realize from the outside whether it was beneficial to you or not.
Well, and you can also get a feeling, right, for how political that tax plan was. It was tailored specifically to cater to the people the Trump administration cares most about. First and foremost, the wealthy, right? But there were also, you know, there was tax restructuring to cater to specific classes of Americans. I obviously am not in one of those. The highly educated were certainly got hosed under the Trump tax reform. My wife is a teacher, and she got hosed really badly. They took away her ability to actually declare her classroom supplies on her taxes. It was a piece of tax legislation that was not just about reforming the tax code. It was about using the tax code as a weapon, and it was effective.
I mean, but really, we can just leave this at, I hope you did your taxes. If you did your taxes, you know how you feel about that.
Yeah.
We will get to the drinking part of the podcast right now. And this is where I say, hey, Sean, man, how was your week and what are you drinking?
So my week was fantastic, but I'm not drinking anything new or interesting. It's interesting, but it's not new. It's an old standby. It's Golden Monkey Belgian style Trappel with added spice from Victory Brewing Company. Yeah, I really, really dig this beer.
As somebody that works for a brewery, we really appreciate people that enjoy core beers and buy core beers, because you can't always be doing something crazy and new. And it's nice to just have good old standby beer. So you don't have to be crazy, because you know what I'm going to be doing? I'm going to be going crazy, because I have pulled out a special beer for this. And and when you open it, it sounds like this.
What is that?
It is the Game of Thrones Seven Kingdoms.
Oh, the Oma Gang or whatever that is. Yeah.
It is a hoppy wheat ale. And I can tell you that that is by far one of my least favorite styles when you refer to it as that. But when you call it a New England style IPA, then it makes it better. I think that New England style IPAs are just kind of hoppy wheat beers. This one, I think, has been banging around since the Whole Foods closed up in Prescott and was selling everything for half off. The whole store, half off. One, I know that everybody likes to say wonderful things about Whole Foods, but I will tell you one thing about the one in Prescott is that on Wednesday, they decided they were closing, and Thursday and Friday, they had a half off sale on everything. And Saturday, the building was cleared out. Everything was off it. And that, and employees found out 2 days before that they were let go. That doesn't even matter. Hey, we're actually going to get into like the politics part of this podcast right about now. We're going to talk a little bit about Paul Gosar at the beginning, little Julian Assange, what's going on over the DHS, the releasing immigrants into sanctuary cities thing, the Israeli election. I think we all kind of talked about, I think we already talked about tax day, but we'll revisit that. Brexit, the Mueller report supposed to come out on Thursday. Away we go. One of the whipping boys of the Plastic Cup Politics podcast is Paul Gosar. There is a recent documentary that came out following Steve Bannon. Part of the documentary was showing a dinner that took place in London, and Paul Gosar was there with a bunch of anti-Islam right-wing leaders from across Europe and Paul Gosar, because, you know, why not? The issue was that he was at this dinner for hours when what he told Congress he was doing is that he was meeting with prime ministers in London. And basically all the prime ministers have said that they would not be anywhere near that meeting.
I think you mean members of parliament.
Members of parliament aren't. Oh, yeah. That's the big one. That's the one at the top.
Okay. Yeah. The prime ministers. It's the top one, and there's not a chance in fucking hell Theresa May is meeting with Paul Gosar. but yeah, there are some MPs out there, particularly Tory MPs, who seem to see the world much the same way that Gosar does. But even they wouldn't sully themselves. Because, you know, I mean, like the people who were at that meeting, it's quaint to refer to them as anti-Islam, but really what they are is pro-white. It was a meeting of white supremacists. They really couldn't care less. You know, I mean, they're anti-Islam only because Pakistanis are the largest non-white immigrant group in England. You switch that up and they're anti something else, right? They'd be anti-Baptist if the largest population was, you know, was blacks from the southern United States.
It's just the one that they're nailing on now.
Yeah. These immigrants happen to be Islamic, right? And so it's a convenient excuse for a very old malady, and that malady is called racism.
When the story on Gosar was first released, it was released by sludge.com and kind of got Sean and I talking about what kind of information, what kind of news outlets we were going to be willing to use for this. And it went from there to the New Times and got picked up by the Arizona Republic. So I think this story might have legs, but then again, I think the story isn't going anywhere. So basically, Paul Gosar lied to Congress about meeting with people. Is this a big deal? Is it negative shit?
At worst, he could actually be punished with like an ethics violation if it turns out that the only way that this trip was able to happen was by use of congressional funds. And the only way he could have gotten those funds was by saying that he was meeting with MPs when in fact he was meeting with a bunch of white supremacists. They could nail him with an ethics violation for that, but it's not, you know, I mean, we're not talking about something that's impeachable. And we've already seen how much his voting base is willing to tolerate from him. I mean, most of them would celebrate the fact that he's meeting with these kind of people. So I don't really see it as impacting him, but it does say something about the potential credibility of the sludge that then two real, you know, real in air quotes, journalistic organizations, two organizations that actually spend money for investigative journalism, were able to vet and corroborate the elements in that story. Because I don't know about the New Times, but I can tell you that the Arizona Republic isn't running that story unless they've been able to corroborate it.
I think that the New Times wouldn't as well. I know they have a pretty good investigative journalism team over there.
Yeah. The story is most likely true, especially given all the, I mean, like, he was really vocal on Facebook, Gosar was, about his support for that, the neo-Nazi asshole who got released from prison in England.
Tommy Robertson, I believe.
Yeah, that guy. It's not like his affiliation with these people is, is a secret. The only part of this story that could potentially have a negative impact for him is the ethics violation.
Lying to Congress. Totally agrees with his base out here where I live. We are talking about a place, as I discussed in the early podcast, where there was a white van with a piece of paper with printed out on it, Death to Islam, driving around in Prescott Valley. So that's how awesome Prescott Valley is.
Meanwhile, the person in that van was probably outrageously high on methamphetamines. But Islam is the problem.
I just really hope that something makes Paul Gosar wear out his welcome, like Julian Assange did. Now, that was a segue.
That was a great segue. Although, so, I think to the people of Ecuador, he wore out his welcome a long goddamn time ago.
I mean, now that it kind of comes out that he's like skateboarding around and breaking shit.
Yeah.
Which I guess that was all okay. It was the releasing Ecuadorian secrets onto the interwebs that might have been his downfall.
What kind of fucking retard do you have to be? And I apologize, actually, to everyone out there who either is retarded or is a family member of someone who is, for associating them with someone like Julian Assange. But, like, how stupid do you have to be to go and release dirt on the one organization that stands between you and an American federal prison? The only thing that I can imagine is that wasn't actually Assange. That was somebody else within WikiLeaks who wanted Assange gone. It was a power play by someone else within the organization.
Hashtag start a conspiracy.
I guarantee you that conspiracy has already been started by someone out there. That's the only other way that doing this makes any kind of sense. You know, the guy's just, he's a self-destructive asshole.
And so he became famous for releasing a bunch of hacked emails from, I can't remember her name, and her name used to be his name.
Chelsea Manning.
Yes. So, and that's basically what the indictment was unsealed. We had an indictment for Julian Assange.
Chelsea Manning, by the way, who is in prison right now. And she refused to cooperate with the grand jury subpoena for her testimony.
In a women's prison?
Yes. And it's, you know, it is testament to sort of the professionalism of the bureaucracy, right? And the fact that, I know I've mentioned this on this show before, but one of the things that people, you know, one of the things that I will occasionally say that sort of shocks people is the last bulwark against tyranny is the bureaucracy, right? It's that professional core of management in the middle of the infrastructure of government that is, especially right now, is all that stands between this country and tyranny. The Federal Department of Corrections, basically, they made appropriate accommodations to ensure, and again, they made those accommodations in a way that is not going to lead to her being on fucking suicide watch again, which is the way that she spent most of her time in the military break. It's certainly not ideal. I don't think she belongs in prison at all at this point. No, actually, let me correct that. And this is an important correction for me to make, actually. So one of the principles of civil disobedience, right, is that in the face of an unjust law or an unjust political outcome, you are willing to accept the consequences of your actions in order to draw attention to how unjust that law or that political outcome is. The law that resulted in Chelsea Manning going to prison right now, right, her being held in contempt of court for refusing to comply with a grand jury summons, That there's nothing tyrannical about that law at all. So procedurally, she is where she's supposed to be. Right. What's important is that everybody understands the sacrifice that she's making in order to draw attention to the fact that the government is still using its monopoly on the use of force to try and prevent us from closely examining its activities. This can get into dicey territory. I'm not sort of an open secrets kind of guy. I think that, like, there are certain things that the government should and does keep secret for, you know, important reasons. But there are other areas where, you know, that is used as cover for nefarious activities. And, you know, I think WikiLeaks has been instrumental in exposing some of that, despite the fact that Julian Assange is a scumbag. All of which goes to say Chelsea Manning should be in prison right now, but all at the same time, she should not.
Why is she against giving grand jury testimony?
Well, that grand jury testimony would ultimately be used to convict Julian Assange.
Then I guess that leads me to the question, should Julian Assange be in jail?
To be perfectly honest, I don't think he should be. Despite the fact that the things he has done have sometimes been damaging to the national security of the United States, I am not entirely sure that he has done anything that we could properly convict him of here in the U.S. Because he didn't do any of it here in the United States. None of it makes any sense. The only way that it's even happening is there was, you know, A, he screwed up and did something stupid with the Ecuadorians, and B, there was some economic arm twisting behind the scenes to get them to cough him up. But that's a political power play. It has nothing to do with international law, because again, international law is largely silent on what he agreed to do. What they've accused him of doing, by the way, is agreeing to decrypt the password for a government computer. So Chelsea Manning provided him with a hashed or encrypted password, and he took it out and got someone, an associate, to crack it. And then he brought the decrypted or the plain text password back to Chelsea Manning, who then used it to be able to get into that sensitive system, download a bunch of data that she then sent to Julian Assange, who then released it via WikiLeaks.
And why is that not wrong?
There's a difference between wrong and something that a foreign citizen should be capable of being convicted of in the United States.
Well, how about this? I know that when WikiLeaks were first being released, that they went through with the Time, Der Spiegel, and the Mirror or the Guardian, I think. And they put it out little bits at a time, and they kind of cleared most of the information, most of the names, any of the sensitive information. The news sources were able to check with the government and let them know what they were looking at and what they were planning on releasing. The government could tell them yes or no.
Although more of that was done by the news sources than by WikiLeaks.
100%.
Yeah.
But then, and everybody was super excited and ready to look. And then WikiLeaks said that they needed a massive amount of money to pay to look through all the 100,000 emails, and then they just dumped them with no redactions, with all names, with everything.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, they suck. Their actions are unethical.
If the Kremlin posted that stuff, would it be okay? Or would we want to find out who got that information and try them in the courts for releasing that information to the Kremlin online? Something.
Here's the thing. So the Kremlin does it. It's essentially an aggressive act by a nation state. Right now, we would want to know if one of our own citizens had supplied that information. And we found out that one of our own citizens did supply it. Chelsea Manning. She went to prison for it and served her time and has now gotten out.
And back in.
And is now back in because we're trying to force her to testify against Julian Assange. what would be extremely difficult for me to accept, right, is if, say, the Kremlin published this information and we tried to convict Wilhelm Kleinman, random fucking German citizen, right, who, because he's an open government, open secrets advocate or blah, 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 whatever, secured this data, passed it on to the wrong person. That person then passed it on to the intelligence community in Russia, who then deployed it to maximum effect by simply dumping it. But yeah, we would consider that an aggressive act by the Russians. We would want to prosecute the American citizen who leaked that data. But the dude in Germany, how, by what fucking means would we convince the Germans to hand over one of their own citizens? Never gonna happen. The only reason this works is because Assange's own home country thinks he's a dickhead, right? And the country that he claimed asylum from, Ecuador, was finally so sick of him and was getting leaned on by the world's sole remaining superpower. Right, but Germany could look back at us and go, fuck you, Wilhelm is just fine. Wilhelm didn't break any laws here in Germany. He's not an American citizen. He wasn't in America when he did this. He didn't break any of your goddamn laws. We're not going to hand you our citizen. I don't understand how it is we claim jurisdiction over Julian Assange.
On my bookshelf right now, I have the Pentagon Papers from Daniel Eisenberg or whatever. So how was that released?
He gave it to the Washington
Post. And then the Post, did they actually look through and make sure that...
They were actually very responsible in the way they deployed that information. They won quite a few awards for it.
As opposed to just throwing it all on the internet?
Yeah, no, like I said, not cool. The guy's an asshole. But what is the legal mechanism by which we're claiming the right to be able to prosecute him and stick him in a cage for the rest of his life? While, by the way, claiming that the International Court in The Hague has no jurisdiction to do the same thing to American citizens for war crimes committed in Central Asia.
I got you. But
it's nothing more than a power play. There is no legal rationale behind it. The only way it works is because we're the biggest, baddest guy on the block, and I don't think the United States should operate that way.
I'll call it a technicality.
Technicality it is. All right.
But feel free to look up all the videos of Donald Trump saying how much he loves WikiLeaks. They are tremendous, and they are plentiful. So Donald Trump loves WikiLeaks. He does not seem to love anybody who falls under the umbrella of the Department of Homeland Security. When we recorded last week, Christian Nielsen had just given her papers. And quick succession, the third in command, which was going to be second in command, also stepped out. And the chief of the Secret Service is also out this week. I think the Secret Service thing might be somewhat related to Mar-a-Lago and the Chinese national that was wandering around Mar-a-Lago with a assortment of cell phones, hard drives, and thumb drives containing malware, which somebody at the Secret Service wanted to know what was on it, so plugged it into their computer. That's how they found out that there was malware. So
there was a little bit of sensationalism there. The forensic investigator from the Secret Service most likely plugged that thumb drive in and extracted its contents into a VM, so a virtual instance, right, a virtual machine, and ran it through a sandbox, which is a sort of environment that we use in information security that we use to detonate malicious software. Right. And observe what it does. We pick it apart. We watch all of its network connections that it tries to make. We, you know, we examine all of its behaviors to try and find indicators of compromise so that we can block it with various pieces of software. So this person at the Secret Service You know, it's not like your average Secret Service agent just grabbed a thumb drive and jacked it into a laptop. This was given to a digital forensics expert who took it back to their lab and detonated it inside a VM. And inside that VM, it immediately began, the malware immediately began trying to install itself and make calls out to C2 infrastructure, blah, 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 blah. And so the forensic investigator captured all of the log data they needed and then shut the VM down and burned it, which is what we do. Standard procedure.
Hey guys, could you tell that was totally Sean's lane?
Yeah. It's interesting, right? Because if you follow, so I follow a bunch of information security people on Twitter, but I do it under my super secret threat intelligence alias. What was interesting was actually to see a bunch of InfoSec people make that same claim that you were making initially, like crowing about how stupid this Secret Service guy was. And even I was initially a little bit like, oh my God, you've got to be kidding me. And then I had to stop and think about it for a second. And I ran it past my now former boss, colleague, Keith, who is on the Secret Service task force for for digital forensics. You know, he was like, the guy was just doing the same thing we do here whenever we find a sample of malicious software. He was detonating it inside a sandbox in a VM. And then, afterwards, he deleted the virtual instance. So it was all SOP. That was just people making, a funny story out of normal stuff.
God damn it, CNN. Fucking hashtag fake news.
Well, that's it just shows you fucking CNN's over-reliance on Twitter for news, by the way. They're fucking terrible about that. They will sit there and talk about tweets from random-ass people. I don't give a fuck what Dan Schmegma from New Jersey has to say about President Trump's latest speech.
But you can tell us at Plastic Cut Pod on all your favorite social media sites because we love all of your tweets, unlike Sean when he's watching CNN, apparently.
No, we care about your tweets because we want to have a conversation with you guys. But you don't fucking present that as goddamn news. I'm not going to take your tweet and post it on Facebook and go look at what this random person has to say about the news of the day. You should hold this up as an example of a way to of a way that you might think about this event that's happened.
Actually, I think that was a better lead in than what I was actually aiming for. But once again, Nielsen's out. They pulled the top pick for ICE, Secret Service directors out. And this is all from DHS, which is now under acting everybody. But when you're talking about all this computer stuff, what else does DHS cover? Because basically Trump wants somebody that's hard on the border. And there's a lot more to the DHS than the border. And I figured that you probably know about a lot of that stuff, because I think of it a lot does have to do with cybersecurity and stuff, correct?
So it's not just cybersecurity, but it's also our, it's our posture vis-a-vis cyber warfare with other nation states too. DHS is instrumental in that as well, but they're also instrumental in, in coordinating domestic intelligence about foreign adversaries here in the United States. They're instrumental. You've got the Secret Service. Most people misunderstand that the Secret Service, all they do is protect the president. That's actually the smallest part of what the Secret Service does. Most of what they do is primarily pursuing financial crimes like counterfeiting and money laundering.
TSA?
TSA, although that's a rough example to bring up because most people would love to see them go away.
Well, I actually I don't agree with that. I think that TSA is probably who you run into the most from the Department of Homeland Security. If I had to say the same thing about goddamn laptops 430 times per day, you know what? I might get kind of monotone and bitchy about saying it too.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
That's also very important, isn't it? Wouldn't you say?
Oh, they also have, what else? Coast Guard. DHS performs a bunch of different functions. What's interesting to note isn't necessarily the lack of leadership at DHS, because these people are being replaced. What's interesting to note about DHS is the interim appointments. Right, because even Trump has tongue-in-cheek acknowledged that what he's doing is an end around the Constitution, right? He's trying to avoid congressional oversight of his nominations. These are picks that are supposed to be vetted and approved by the Senate. And this president doesn't think he should have to do that. So he's just decided to go with interim appointments for executive positions.
Which I wanted to bring up because I don't think we covered this when we were kind of talking about the interim and all that stuff before. Mick Mulvaney is interim chief of staff.
Yeah, so that's a weird one. I don't...
Did you catch up to that too? Because that you don't need congressional approval.
Chief of staff, yeah, so I don't understand why they're still calling him acting. Because, I mean, he's just the chief of staff at this point.
Right, he doesn't need approval. He can just say, you are now chief of staff.
Yeah.
And guess what? He gets new business cards.
I don't get it. That whole thing is a mystery.
Because we were talking about how much, you know, like, recent foreign policy may have been changed by Mick Mulvaney. Dude, if you're going to take advice from the guy, just make him chief of staff. Anyway, sorry for that little interjection, but...
I don't think it's little, to be honest, though. I mean, it's indicative of the kind of chaos that's going on inside that building.
Did nobody tell him he can just make him chief of staff?
I don't think anyone has. Either that or just no one's brought it up again since he made him interim chief of staff or acting chief of staff or whatever. They just haven't bothered to bring it back up and go, oh, hey, is he the permanent chief of staff now? They've just moved on. Is they don't understand that this shit is important. Right? I mean, like, they think they shouldn't have to do any of it at all, let alone worry about the Mick Mulvaney part, which Congress doesn't give a shit about anyway. Which is weird, to be honest. The chief of staff, I mean, I kind of get it, because the chief of staff, right, is supposed to be a very personal pick to the president, right? It's the president's very closest advisor and sort of the person who is the field marshal for the president's agenda. At the same time, the chief of staff, you could conceivably consider them one of the top, like, four or five most powerful people on Earth. That really seems like the kind of position that begs for congressional oversight.
It just feels like, you know, when you had in your friend group that one person who thought that you were, like, really their friend, but you were like, you're the first one that I'm going to jettison out of this friend group if I ever get the chance. I feel like Trump's really waiting for, like, one of his real friends. Like, maybe Vince McMahon will come over and be chief of staff. But you know, like, that's going to be, like, a perm, because they're, like, bros. But, like, Mick Mulvaney is like, no, man. I love hanging out with you. No, I mean, like, you're, like, almost full chief of staff, bro.
Yeah, it's so close.
But you're almost there. Just keep coming up with those ideas.
Yeah. The sad part is I could absolutely picture that conversation happening in real life.
Mick, what do you got now? What do you got now? boss, how about we take all the immigrants we find and we send them to those sanctuary cities? How about we do that? You are now advanced interim assistant to chief of staff. That was a great idea. Let's roll with that. Hey, everybody, how do you think that sounds?
Except that plan didn't come from Mick Mulvaney.
Oh.
That plan came from...
Is he from Santa Monica?
No. Is he from Santa... Please don't tell me he's from Santa... There's no way that guy is from Santa Monica. It's Stephen Miller.
Santa Monica, bro.
Oh, Jesus. Really?
Yes.
I guess even Santa Monica could produce one of them. Holy shit.
Yeah, he was on the tennis team.
How the fuck do you live in Santa Monica and still be that evil? Dude, the guy, I swear to God, he's in like his 30s or something. He already looks like Montgomery Burns from The Simpsons.
Well, yes, good old Stephen Miller. The reason that I mean, because this is ridiculous and that this actually was thought of and put in front of people that had to say, no, moving these people to sanctuary cities is dumb because they're only here for a few days before they find their family or whoever is they're going to meet. Much like when they're talking about Bisbee and about, oh, you live so close to the border, there's got to be all kinds of problems with immigration. When you rob a bank, you don't stand outside.
Yeah.
You go where you're going. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they had to say, no, you can't do that. What it really reminded me of was 1995 when the Super Bowl was here, when the Super Bowl was in Arizona. I think it was the Steelers Cowboys.
Yeah. This notorious episode.
We in Phoenix gave all the homeless people bus tickets to San Diego.
Yeah.
That's what we did to get rid of our homeless problem. We bought them bus tickets to San Diego, which I think is basically what was proposed in the Trump era.
You know the local industry that probably made the most money off of that Super Bowl?
Greyhound?
Prostitutes.
Oh, I can see that. I wouldn't want to see that.
It got to a point, actually, where there were prostitutes openly soliciting business at, like, the corner of Hayden and Indian School, corner of Hayden and Thomas, which, for our international listeners, isn't the poshest part of Scottsdale, but it's still Scottsdale, which is one of the wealthier cities on the planet. And there typically are not prostitutes anywhere openly advertising their wares in Scottsdale, let alone on a 6-lane thoroughfare at one of the busiest intersections in the city.
Yes, they usually stick to Van Buren, although I've been going up and down recently because that's my favorite way to get across town from downtown. And I haven't seen much action recently. I don't know what they're doing now that the back pages are gone, but not that I'm strolling, by the way. It's just literally my favorite way of getting around. I believe we talked about Doug Stanhope on another episode. Listen to his episode about the transvestite hooker that takes place on Van Buren, if you're an international listener, and you will learn more about Van Buren than you may ever have possibly wanted to know.
Certainly from Doug Stanhope, you might. Holy cow.
All right. I want to get into some international stuff. The Israeli election happened. I know that I don't know if anybody really paid attention. I know that a lot of you paid attention, but some of you didn't. Netanyahu won again. Netanyahu, who is he's currently under investigation for corruption, he won slightly, but he won. And I just kind of want to run some. I guess you can tell me what you think about that. And then I want to run some terms by you to see if you can give me a quick explanation on them.
Sure. In terms of his win, by the way, a lot of our listeners aren't going to be familiar with parliamentary politics. But essentially what happened was parties with which Netanyahu and his party are allied won enough votes to barely form a coalition that constitutes a majority of the parliament. So Netanyahu and his party themselves did not net enough votes to actually form a majority, but unfortunately he has effectively managed to cobble together a coalition to form a government.
With parties that were further to the right than his party. So basically in this election, it was the far right candidate versus the pretty right middle kind of ish candidate.
Yes. And post-election, the Knesset passed legislation essentially doing away with the idea of Israel as a modern liberal democracy. And by liberal democracy, I do not mean like a progressive democracy. I mean, liberal in the classical sense, i.e. free, fair elections, blah, 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 political and legal equality, etc. So they passed a law that essentially said that Israel is a Jewish state and that non-Jewish Israeli citizens will now have officially a second-class status. And it effectively advocates the annexation, or it essentially mandates government support for settlement of the Palestinian territories. by Jewish settlers. These kinds of elections have immediate consequences, and that was one of them. And we have yet to see the consequences of that vote, but they will be there. It's the kind of provocation that groups in the Arab world are not likely to take sitting down, even though they have distanced themselves from the Palestinian cause somewhat as of late.
And so they are basically discussing this as the end of the two-state solution, which has been endorsed by the United States for quite a while. Was it Clinton that first came out in support of the two-state solution?
Well, yeah, but, you know, essentially the two-state solution is mandated by international law. International law makes it illegal for you to effectively annex territory that you seized in war. You know, under international law, there is no way for Israel to legally keep the Palestinian territories. The only question is whether they could find a solution that would entice the Palestinians to voluntarily join with Israel in a one-state solution, right? Or if they could create a framework whereby there could be a two-state solution. But at no time did anyone say, hey, look, there is a legal third option whereby Israel could simply just annex the Palestinian territories. Internationally, under international law, what they're doing is illegal. And according to U.S. foreign policy until the Trump administration, what they were doing was anathema to U.S. national interests, right, and U.S. foreign policy. And it still is anathema to our national interest, right, to our national security. But unfortunately, our foreign policy has been altered so that this is perfectly in line with it.
Yeah. Didn't we just kind of get upset with Russia over annexing Crimea? Or what?
Yeah, Crimea, part which was part of the Ukraine.
Right. And didn't they think that was bad? So Donald Trump just gave up the Golan Heights?
Basically told Israel just that recognized. We would recognize their sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Yeah.
Which was taken by war in 69, I believe, or somewhere around there.
Mm-hmm.
How is what happened to Crimea different than what happened to Golan Heights?
There is no difference. None whatsoever. You know, even the rationale behind the two, right? Both sides deploy a historical justification, right? And simultaneously a national security interest. Right. So Russia claims that Crimea is primarily Russian, like the people who live there are primarily of Russian descent. And they have some historical justification for why Crimea should still be a Russian territory. And at the same time, it's also overtly, you know, a political issue, right? Because Crimea also happens to encompass Russia's only southern deep water port for its navy. And so they absolutely could not lose Crimea. And they were starting to see the Ukrainian government go in the direction of anti-Russian forces. And so they needed to annex Crimea in order to preserve access to that port. So, you know, they offered both justifications. Well, the Israelis do the exact same thing, right? They offer
Golan Heights.
Yeah.
Golan Heights are the high ground.
Mm-hmm.
They got bombed the shit out of from the Golan Heights, so they think that that should be theirs.
Yeah, and at the same time, the Zionists in Israel also offer a historical slash biblical justification for why the Golan Heights also belong to Israel. The situations are actually fairly similar. The only difference is in the way the United States responded to them. One thing I would say, however, is that the response to the annexation of Crimea was under the previous administration. This administration likely would have responded to the annexation of Crimea very differently.
I guess that is a valid point that we may never know the answer to. But I think you will have the answer to this question about a word that has been coming up again recently, apartheid. what is apartheid and why is it coming up in reference to Israel? I know it from South Africa.
Yeah, and that's where essentially everyone knows it from.
Good.
That's how the regime in Africa, where there was essentially one legal system for white people and another legal system for black people, and essentially no political representation for black people at all. And what's more, the white population in South Africa was actually the minority. If I'm not sure if statistically it's already the case, or based on birth rates, it will eventually be the case. But, you know, the Jews may already be a minority in sort of Israel-Palestine relative to the Arab population. So, you know, there's plenty of analogs there.
Those that have power want to hold on to power?
Yes, very much so.
And then another term that I've been hearing, what is a nation state? Other than a sweet propaganda song, which I think might just become the title for this episode.
So a nation would be the way to refer to an ethnic people, right? And a state would be the sort of territorial entity that we would commonly think of as a country, right? So if you are a nation state, you are both a territorial entity as well as an ethnic entity.
Like, would that be the Navajo Nation?
Exactly.
That would be a nation state. Their reservation is a nation state?
Yes, it's a physical territory, a political system, and an ethnic group.
Okay, and that's what they're kind of discussing Israel being as well?
That's actually the consequence of the legislation they passed, yeah.
What happens to marginalized people in nation states?
It doesn't tend to go well for them.
I know that sounded like the dumbest way to frame that question, but you know what I mean, that in honesty.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's actually a good lead in to the fact that we have an analogous situation right here in the United States. We've seen how well it went for people who are marginal in terms of both the percentage of the population and the territory that they occupy. It has not gone well for the Native Americans until very recent history, and then only fueled by the addiction of of Westerners. What fuck? Who knows? To everyone, of humans, to gambling, right?
And to all you can eat crab legs.
Yeah, it's the renaissance, if you can call it that, on the reservations has been largely fueled by gambling revenues, right? But otherwise, they still remain a sort of a legally ghettoized people. That's not a secure or healthy position to operate from for anyone. And in Israel in particular, you're talking about a confederated government that just recently incorporated a group, right? A party, a minority party that is openly racist. It advocates that the Jewish people are a superior people, that the Arab people are an inferior people, and it advocates policies of extermination or relocation. And if those policies sound familiar, they should, right? There have been analogies to the Nazis in the past, and this party in question has not shied away from them, right?
And so, they are part of the winning coalition in Israel.
Yeah. So you're talking about laws based on ethnicity and based on these weird sort of political science-y definitions of things like nation states that have very real and very serious real world consequences for certain people, right? You're talking about a subpopulation in Israel right now that is extremely nervous. If I'm an Israeli Arab, I'm not entirely sure I feel safe staying in Israel right now.
How safe do you feel on a normal night?
Actually, for Israeli Arabs, right, so which are separate from the people in the Palestinian territories, right? Like going into the history of the Palestinian territories, that would be several podcasts in and of itself. At some point, I'm sure Dan Carlin will cover it on History. the people who were expelled from their land, essentially the Israeli invasion in 1948. And then there were people who stayed behind inside the territory of Israel, but who were not Jewish. Right? They were Arabs who were already living on the land. They weren't expelled by any settlers right then. They didn't choose to flee. They stayed. And they were incorporated into Israel. And Israel long prided itself on being the only liberal democracy in the Middle East. Right? And that it was truly a liberal democracy. Despite having a distinctly Jewish identity and character, it was still welcoming to people of all religions and cultures and ethnic backgrounds, and they all had political equality. Over time, that has eroded to the point where for probably a good 10 years now, Israeli Arabs have complained of sort of second-class citizen status. That status has now been encoded officially in law.
Sweet.
So elections have consequences, and sometimes those consequences look a lot like genocide.
You know, or at least the first steps of it. We're going to follow that Judas cow right into, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, that it was tax day. Are we ever going to see Trump's taxes?
Yeah, I think we will. At some point, here's the question. Will we see them while he is in office?
Will we ever see him if he's in while he's in office?
That seems unlikely.
What's up with them just kind of like stonewalling Congress on everything? We were supposed to know the report on Khashoggi like a month ago. It was supposed to be a report to Congress. The White House said, nah, we're not going to do that. And then we just all went, okay. They put through a resolution to pull back any support of the war in Yemen in support of the Saudis. That made it through the House, made it through Congress. Not a bunch, but more than a handful of Republicans in both the House and Senate said, yeah, man, we don't like what your support of the leader of Saudi Arabia, how we don't want to be like supporting this war. And so Trump used his second veto. The first was when we said, hey, man, we really, really don't think that we need a wall. And then Congress said, yeah, dude, we totally don't need a wall. And he said, yeah, we totally do. I veto that. So this is his second veto saying that, no, we should still be in this war in perfunctory. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Away with Saudi Arabia.
Here's the tricky part. Legally, the Trump administration may actually be right. Now, in principle, what Congress is trying to do right now is the right thing to do, and they should have done it many times before and failed to do so. Only in this Congress would we look at it as a success that they chose the exact wrong time to do the right thing, right? So they're doing the right thing, but this is the wrong moment to do it. Because technically, so far as we know, we are not engaged in hostilities in Yemen. We are providing logistical and intelligence support to an ally. And legally, it is the president's purview to do that. That is an argument that they could convincingly make in court.
It didn't work for Charles Manson.
Yeah, well, you know, Charles Manson didn't have a monopoly on the use of force, at least outside of his own head. I don't like the sound of it either, but that's the way the law reads. There's a definition to hostilities, right, that would rise to the level of war. And that's the criteria that the activity has to meet before it rises to the level where the War Powers Act applies. There's no way to construe what we're doing in Yemen as being engaged in combat. We're just not. We're providing in-air refueling, I guess. So we're allowing the Saudi jets to have enough range to reach their targets in Yemen. So we are facilitating combat, but we're not engaged in it. And I think that they could properly make a legal case that falls outside the purview of the War Powers Act.
The president can just say, you can help do this shit over here, and Congress has no say over whether that happens or not?
Up to a certain level, yeah.
Whoa, that's pretty sweet, I guess. I guess the president does more cool shit than I thought.
There's a lot of leeway built into these laws and regulations about how the president can deploy military force. And a lot of that leeway only comes about as a result of the introduction of nuclear weapons. Prior to the advent of the Cold War, right, the introduction of nuclear weapons, it was actually fairly difficult for the president to go to war without Congress's explicit approval, because the president would need to go to Congress to get the money first in order to engage in that kind of campaign, right? We're talking about things that took place at a much slower pace. And then we got to the point where the entire world could be annihilated in 30 minutes or less. And we realized that war by legislative council might not work anymore. So we built in a little bit of leeway. Right? So the president, for example, can engage in full-scale hostilities for up to 90 days before he has to engage, before he has to seek congressional authorization. Now, at 90 days and 1 millisecond, Congress can pass a resolution that says, fuck you, you get no more money, pull all the troops out. That is also absolutely within their purview to do, and the president legally would have to do it. Question is, and this goes back to where we started, why does it seem like they keep defying Congress's orders?
Because there's not a troop on the ground?
The question is, how does Congress enforce its orders?
Taking back the money? Oh, I forgot they don't control the purse. Weren't they supposed to control the purse strings?
Technically, they do, right? They have the ability to write and pass the budget. But the Treasury is an executive branch. So they don't actually control the money. They control the budget, but they don't control the money.
Oh, so the president can just pay for wars and pay to do stuff without any congressional oversight? Because he runs the Treasury?
No, not true. Although this president seems to think it might be.
I mean, we seem to be getting a wall. Is that because he runs the Treasury?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. Despite the fact that the media really needs to sell the idea that there is a wall being built.
Oh, we know there's not, but...
There is indeed not a wall being built. And I doubt very seriously that there ever will be.
But that money came from around Congress.
Yeah, no, you're right. But that issue also has not been fully litigated yet. Right? Congress can and most likely will go to court. You asked like 2 weeks ago for sort of red lines to look out for with regard to Brexit, right? Let me offer up a little bit of a red line to look out for with regard to fascism and its influence in the Trump administration. Thus far, we have not seen a situation where the Trump administration has engaged in an activity, Congress has litigated or has legislated against it, the Trump administration has defied that, Congress has gone to court, the courts have ruled against the administration, and the administration has continued to defy that order. We haven't gotten to that point yet. If we do, if we get to the point where a court is about to rule against the Trump administration on behalf of the Congress, that is the moment where the American people should collectively hold their breath and pray to whatever God they hold dear that the better angels of our legislators and executives' natures kick in. Because for those people who aren't familiar with the history, the last time this country fought a civil war, it was with muzzle-loading rifles and 500,000 people died. A civil war this time around would not go nearly as well.
Especially since us hippies don't have guns. Well, I mean, us hippies have guns, but...
Yeah, I was going to say, that turns out to not be true at all. Yeah, that was the funniest one, is when they published that stupid-ass meme, like, oh, yeah, they're talking about a civil war. Who has all the guns? It's like, actually, we got a whole fuckload of guns over here, and we're pretty good. with the guns that we have. We like guns. Guns are great.
I would like to think that I have the proper amount of firearms. Okay, just so we have to hit it. Brexit. We're saved. Yay! got pushed back to Halloween. May said that she wanted till the end of May. And they went, you seem to have no idea what the fuck you're doing. We'll give you to Halloween. Are we not going to have to cover this until late September?
No, we will have to cover it again before then. And here's why. What we avoided at this point, right, was the certainty of crashing out. Right. That's the UK leaving the European Union with no exit plan, which would have happened last Friday had the EU not intervened and extended the deadline. In terms of what we have not avoided, but what have we created at this point, what the EU did was they looked at the UK's request and they went, first of all, in order for us to want to grant you your extension on your timeline, we would have to have faith that you could do something meaningful with it. We no longer have that faith. That being the case, right? So what the EU wanted to avoid was like getting up to the day before the elections for the European Parliament and having the UK crash out that day. Because that's the absolute drop dead date. Right. The day of those EU elections. And so the European Union went, no, we'll extend your deadline, but we're going to extend it well past the dates for the European Union elections. And you're going to have to field candidates. The implicit message there, right, or the functional message is Brexit is far less likely today than it was yesterday.
Mueller report supposed to come out on Thursday. What are you expecting?
I am expecting it to be bad for the Trump administration. The question is, will it be bad enough that Congress has to step in? It seems to be a certainty that even the most, well, perhaps not the most biased of us, but even some of the more biased of us will have to admit that there is a difference between the interpretation that Attorney General Barr offered and what is actually in the Mueller report that we all see on Thursday. Even Barr seems to have sort of implicitly admitted that that's the case. The question is there enough of a difference there that even the moderate Republicans in Congress, which are loath to do anything anti-Trump because they might be primaried, that even they will have to act? The sad part of that statement is the implicit notion that Trump's hardcore supporters can't be counted on to act in the best interest of the United States under any circumstance.
But guess what? Sean's going to read all that shit, and he's going to tell you what's actually in it for an upcoming episode of Plastic Cup Politics. I hope you enjoyed this one. If you did, go ahead and give us a nice little rate and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. You can interact with the show at Plastic Cup Pod on all your favorite social media sites. If you want to know Sean's super secret Twitter handle, that is XMAGAX. So, like, MAGA straight edge. Follow him at XMAGAX on Twitter.
You busted.
Dope rhymes over there. Thank you guys for listening. Tell a friend. And we'll talk to you guys again next week.
Hell yeah. Whoa!